Hello, and welcome to And Other Duties, the life of the assistant conductor, with me, your host, Karen Evrin. This is a podcast highlighting the lives of conductors from all over the world, telling their stories of what it is assistant conductors really do. Not only that, but these are guests and people who I have personally collaborated and connected with, whom I admire, whom I turn to, and whom I share this crazy, exhilarating, thrilling journey with. Without these connections, our brilliantly bizarre profession would feel far too lonely. Having worked as an assistant conductor for over 6 years, from Ireland to the UK and the USA, I want to help spread the incredible stories of those of us who are normally behind the scenes. A huge thank you to IT Passion for supporting this series of And Other Duties. This week's guest is the newly appointed head of conducting at London's Royal College of Music. Recognised as a leader in the conducting community, at the beginning of the pandemic, he launched Conductors in Isolation, an online forum which now has over 1,600 members worldwide. This conductor has worked as an assistant to Mark Wigglesworth, Ryan Wigglesworth, Edward Gardiner and Anthony Nagus. In 2016, he was announced as the English National Opera Macarius Conducting Fellow. He's the music director of the new Sussex Opera, founding music director of the Vienna Opera Festival and Academy. He has conducted Opera Nationale de Paris, St. Petersburg Festival Orchestra, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. In the opera pit, he has conducted Grange Park Opera, Buxton Festival, Lyric Opera Dublin, the Sirius Ensemble, Bampton Classical Opera, British Youth Opera, and Chelsea Opera Group. This conductor has been a huge part of my conducting journey. As one of my very first teachers at the Sherborne Summer School of Music, he has become a great colleague, someone I really admire, and a really good friend. Toby, it truly is such a pleasure and honour to welcome you to And Other Duties, the life of the assistant conductor.
Thanks so much, Karen. I'm so thrilled you asked me to be here. And obviously, I've known you and admired your work for a while. So I'm thrilled to have this chance to reconnect.
Well, as I said in the introduction, you were a big part of my journey right from the very start, all those years ago in Sherborne. So it's lovely to have these connections. And it's something I'm sure people are sick of me saying, but it is so important to have your board of directors and people you can call on. And you're definitely one of those for me.
Thank you.
We're going to go right back to the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your music journey and how did you get into conducting?
Well, the way I got into conducting was a fortunate accident. So initially I wanted to be a pianist. Like one of my first ever musical memories was when I was at kindergarten and the piano teacher, well, a lady came in to play piano for songs. And my family wasn't musical at all. And I used to go home every evening and say to my mother, I've learned the most wonderful new song today, and I'd sing it. And at the end of term, the teacher said to my parents, well, we don't think Toby's very musical. He doesn't take part in singing any of the songs. And it turned out, because I was just pulling up a chair and sitting next to the piano teacher and staring at her hands, absolutely obsessed and fascinated. And the teacher thought I wasn't musical. But my mother said, but he comes home every evening and sings us the song. So they realized quickly that I was really interested in music, and actually this same person who had played piano when I was at kindergarten became my first piano teacher.
Aww.
And then that was a kind of a passion, and until I was about 18 I thought I wanted to be a pianist. But when I was, so I was very lucky to be at a very musical school. It was a private school which really didn't, it allowed you to sit in a practice room for 8 hours a day and not feel like you were a strange person. You know, it kind of encouraged you to pursue your passions.
Love it.
And one of the things we had to do in our third year was we had to choose between doing officer cadet training, so army so marching up and down, or some kind of community service.
Okay.
And I chose gardening because I grew up, my parents were wonderful gardeners, and I love the countryside. And so I chose gardening, and my piano teacher promptly said, you can't do gardening, it's bad for your wrists. So I had to go back to the head of the community services again. He said, well, my piano teacher won't let me do this. Is there anything else I can do? And he said, well, actually, there's a retired teacher who's just moved into the area, And he wants somebody to visit him once a week just for conversation. And that was quite a normal thing. I don't know whether it would be allowed now because I just basically jumped on my bicycle, cycled off to a total stranger's house, went and sat down and had tea and cake. And one of his first questions was, so what are you reading at the moment? And I said, I'm reading a book by Sir Adrian Bolt. Adrian Bolt was a very famous British conductor. And it is his book called The Point of the Stick. And this gentleman's eyes lit up and he said, Sir Adrian was my teacher and I was a conductor. So this gentleman had been head of music at a leading public school. And he said, look, next week, bring a baton and I'll teach you how to conduct. And it all started from that very, very fortunate accident, basically, of fate. So the school enabled me to put together a group of my friends. I put together a small orchestra. I started doing some concerts. I then went and... So by the time I was 18, I was seriously not sure whether I wanted to be a pianist or a conductor. Wow. So I went to Vienna for a year and I studied piano. At the end of that year, I was certain I didn't want to be a pianist.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I went off to read music at Oxford. But by that time, I'd also been introduced to a man called George Hurst, who was basically became my guru. He became he is and was the biggest influence on me as a musician and as a conductor. And so every summer from the age of 17 onwards, I spent summer masterclass studying with him. And for the 6 years, I basically went as a student and then I became his pianist and then I became his assistant. And so that was a lifelong, he died 10 years ago.
Yes.
And that was but his influence was massive on so many conductors around the world.
Yep.
And it was him who actually told me that after 5 years of studying with him, he said, you need to go and study with Ilya Musin.
Wow.
Who was the other great teacher. And so I went and spent the best part of 2 years studying in St. Petersburg in Russia. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the biggest influence on me in terms of the way I approach my own conducting in a physical sense.
Yep.
So from George Hurst, I feel I gained sort of a sense of musical integrity, an approach to the score, a sort of honesty. And you know, if there was one thing I could claim something as a real mantra, it's simply honesty.
Mm.
And you know, we have to be so honest as conductors to make sure we're always putting the music first, at the service of the orchestra, at the service of the composer. But of course, not limiting our own individual talent and passion. So those were my main influences. And alongside that, I was setting up orchestras. So I studied music at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was pretty sure I wanted to be a conductor by that stage, I was able to sort of manufacture what I studied to help me as a conductor. So I specialized in middle period Verdi opera, for example.
Wow.
I did keyboard skills, orchestration, analysis, and all of these kind of things which really helped me as a conductor. Set up an orchestra there, then went off to St. Petersburg to study with Musin, and then finally came back to try to make sense. Mm. So this is by the end of 2 years in St. Petersburg, I was totally confused because I'd had five years of George Hurst with a technique based on the Toscanini Barzan technique.
Yes.
So Toscanini, obviously one of the greatest conductors of the 20th century. And Barzan had been the principal viola of the New York Philharmonic and had basically codified Toscanini's technique. And Toscanini spotted him as a talented conductor in his own right and said, you're sacked from the orchestra, but you're going to become a conductor. And so Barzan became this great teacher of Toscanini's way of conducting. And he taught George Hurst that. So I'd been taught the Toscanini technique until I was about 22. And then I went off to learn this Russian technique, which superficially at least felt very, very different.
Mm.
And at the end of that, you know, I came back looking, Musin was 94 when I studied with him.
Wow.
So I came back looking like a 94, you know, I'd been copying him. So I looked like a 94-year-old with arthritis. But, I then had to go and spent 3 years at the Royal Academy of Music in London.
Wow.
With Colin Metters,
yes,
who I honestly think is the greatest living conducting teacher.
Oh,
he
wow.
is amazing. So so if anyone has a chance to go and do a masterclass with Colin, I guarantee it will change your life. And he enabled me to see that actually these two seemingly different approaches were actually very similar.
Wow.
They just approached a similar concept, but from a different angle.
Yeah.
And he enabled me to make that my own. And as a result, I feel able when I conduct to feel that I'm natural in my own body. And that also informs the way I teach. Mm. So I'm head of conducting at the Royal College of Music. So a lot of my life is spent mentoring and trying to support young conductors and obviously enabling them to be themselves. What I really regret is when I see a young conductor who's clearly been taught by copying the way their teacher conducts, because it's pre-digested food.
Yes, you know? Yes, it's like, exactly.
You know, you need to create your own cake, not somebody else's.
It goes back to that honesty too, Dobie, doesn't it? As a person and conductor, I mean, you talk about the music, but also on the podium, we have to be honest with who we are, because, you know, ego is a huge part of conducting, unfortunately, but you have to be kind and caring and just who you are on the podium rather than trying to be a dictator or, you know, somebody with power, because the music is powerful enough that one doesn't need to do anything else with it.
For any conductor, you know, at any stage of their experience, whether they're straight out of music college or especially if they're actually quite new to conducting on a professional level, you know, you stand in front of a professional orchestra and they have all those years of experience in front of them. You know, they've played for some of the greatest living conductors, some of the greatest conductors of the past as well. And there you are standing in front of them, having to have the authority to make them be happy to play for you.
Yep.
You know, say that this person is standing here because they deserve to be there, not because they've been put there by an agent or by management, or they've paid their way in or something like that. Mm. So, you know, you have to prove yourself. And that's where I think it's psychologically really difficult, because, you know, the harder we try, normally the worse we do.
Yes.
You know, it takes a huge amount of self-confidence and self-knowledge to be able to be relaxed, to be humble, but at the same time, you know, have that strength, that leadership.
Yeah, totally.
What's the expression? It's servant leadership,
you know, yes.
Which is, you know, when you are able to listen to what everyone around you needs and be at their service, but at the same time with a vision for what you believe they need.
Yes.
And that partnership and that happy marriage. And, you know, I think that's what we all aim for when we're in front of an orchestra. And sometimes it works. You know, sometimes it just clicks.
Yes.
And you have an orchestra which just returns your love, returns your energy.
Yep.
And then you can get an orchestra which has had a really bad day and they just aren't interested.
Yes.
And that's also really hard, because then how do you deal with that?
Yes,
You've got to get through a rehearsal, you've got to get through a concert, and you're finding there's a wall of resistance between, you know, they're just not interested in what you've got to offer because they just want to do their job and go home.
Yeah.
And I don't have an easy answer for that, except you just have to be empathetic.
Yes.
And you have to keep communicating and keep doing your best, and we can't do more than our best.
No.
We know we have to just be, we can offer all we can offer. We can't do more than that.
No, and I think to realise that it's not your fault at that point, that sometimes exterior things play a factor. Like, this is, you know, episode number 6 of having played this all week or whatever it is. And that's just how they feel, and it's no reflection on you. And personally, that's something that I have struggled with from time to time, is just taking stock and being like, as you said, just be empathetic, do what you can. Don't do more than that. Don't become, you know, too sort of bowing down either, and recognize that that's just what's happening.
Yeah. And I think that awareness is easy for us to say now in isolation, away from the situation.
Exactly.
But when you're rabbit in headlights.
Totally.
I had a very bad experience. I won't mention the orchestra, but I know I won't be invited back.
Okay.
And it was because I was so nervous standing in front of them for the first time.
Wow.
And I thought I'd been really nice in my rehearsal schedule,
because
it was one of these one rehearsal and a concert situation, and there was a lot of repertoire. And I thought I'd start by stuff with the fewest number of musicians and gradually get bigger. So that me thinking, okay, first time, I'll be really nice. I'll only call all the heavy brass for the end of the rehearsal rather than having that schedule hadn't been shared with the orchestra. So the whole orchestra was sitting on the stage at the beginning of rehearsal. And I still went ahead with the schedule I had devised.
Right.
Which meant standing with a piece which was, it was Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending, which I've done many times. I know it really well. But what I hadn't been prepared for was the degree of delay in this particular orchestra sound.
Right.
So suddenly I was like, oh my goodness, I don't know where the sound is.
Wow.
What I'm doing physically is not connecting to what I'm expecting to hear. And that was such a mistake on my part to begin with something as subtle as that,
yes,
to begin a rehearsal when I'm not used to the orchestra yet, and where their sound is, how they relate, how far behind the beat the wind is going to play, and things like that.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt like I was swimming.
Oh, wow.
And as a result, they felt I didn't know my score.
Wow.
And I know in my heart, nothing could be further from the truth. Mm. I really do know that score. But I projected insecurity,
yes,
because I wasn't in control of myself in relation to how the orchestra was expecting me to relate to them.
Yeah.
And so I've learned from that mistake. I now know I should have started with The Marriage of Figaro over that rehearsal.
Yeah.
And, you know, found the energy, find the sparkle, get everyone in a happy mood,
and
you know,
go,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So planning your, I mean, there are so many lessons to learn from that, but one of them is planning your rehearsal schedule,
mm-hmm,
in a way that enables you also,
yes,
to do your best.
Yeah.
So we all want to be nice and kind,
yeah,
to the orchestra. And it's very important, obviously, to plan a rehearsal in a way that you don't have a third trombone playing at the beginning and they're not playing for 2 hours.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
I mean, you could say, well, they're paid for the whole rehearsal. Why does it matter?
Yeah, of course.
In a sense, but in terms of just human kindness.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's bad planning if you've got to have people coming on and off stage between pieces because everything's different. So, so it's very good to plan your, you know, I mean, every program is different and has different demands. So, but that was a case of me trying to be too nice in terms of the orchestra and actually letting myself down.
And trusting your gut when you see a piece on it saying, I really know that, like, nothing's going to throw me on that one, be it Marriage of Figaro or something else, and jumping in, because yes, be kind and do all those things, but they will respect you more if they see that sparkle straight away and you're in. However, they didn't see that sparkle and you learned from it, and it didn't take from your career. I'm sure it felt like death at the time. I'm sure it was just like, I'm never going to conduct again, what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. But we have to go through those things to realise that it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. If you're good enough, you will survive.
Well, exactly. I mean, the truth is the concert went really well.
Oh, good.
And I know quite a lot of members of the orchestra who went along saying, that was actually a really good concert. We really enjoyed it. Mm. But I also know that I won't be invited back because management got the message in the break that they didn't think I knew my score well enough.
Wow, wow.
So,
that's hard, Toby.
Yeah, it is hard. And I must say it took me a long time to to recover from that disappointment.
Yes.
Because I felt really, I'd let myself down really badly.
Wow.
And it's so easy to do, you know.
Yeah.
It's just
It's a hard world. And, you know, this podcast is obviously called And Other Duties, The Life of the Assistant Conductor. And you've had this amazing journey with teachers that I want to get back to a little bit later on. But I want to ask you about English National Opera and winning the Mackerras Fellowship. How did that come about? At what point were you in your career or education? I mean, we're always learning, so you kind of always have to say you're in education. But how did it come about?
So when I was at music college, I didn't do anything like enough opera.
Okay.
And I think if I could turn back time,
mm-hmm,
one of the things I would have done right from the beginning is bury myself in opera.
Wow, okay.
I mean, it's the complete artwork. And it's also, it's such an exciting challenge as a conductor. It's also where you can build a really good career for yourself.
Yes.
Because if you find yourself a position in an opera company,
mm-hmm,
whether it's in Germany or Italy or wherever, or Britain, obviously there are fewer opera companies, there are fewer opportunities in Britain. because there are fewer opera companies than, say, Germany, which has the largest number. But I know that some of the most rewarding work I had done had been when I started getting into opera, initially through Grange Park Opera, who gave me really, to be honest, my first big opportunities. And then I did some assisting for Ed Gardner at English National Opera when he was music director.
Yes.
And then Mark Wigglesworth was appointed music director of English National Opera. Well, Mark Wigglesworth is one of the conductors I admire, like, above almost anybody else. He's just the most wonderful combination of passion and integrity and honesty and all those qualities I strive for myself. And so when he was music director, I was really keen to be able to work alongside him and to assist him and learn from him. I'm not 100% certain what my age was, but I think I was around about 39.
That's wonderful.
And I actually, I know that there was some conversation when they were choosing who to appoint about my age.
Wow.
And but we want somebody younger. And Mark was, well, actually, no, I want somebody who can do the job.
Yes.
So Mark, I know, fought my corner, and for which I'm forever grateful.
I actually have chills listening to that, Toby, because it's so important. I mean, obviously, to me, age is only ever a number, but it does become a factor when the cutoff is 35 and you have to have all of this done by this age. And we, as I just said, we never stop learning. So for him to have given that gift must have just felt incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something which, as conductors, it's difficult because we live in an age where people are looking for the next exciting young thing.
Yes.
And I think, I don't want to, I mean, this is a huge generalization. I know there are so many exceptions, but if you had to make a huge generalization, you can understand why the agents and the managers are looking for, you know, the next exciting young competition winner who's going to be the next exciting, you know, figure on the block.
Yes.
And when you're a bit older, it's hard because you kind of feel that everyone's looking for somebody younger than you.
Yes.
And I'm happy to say that there are competitions now which don't have age limits.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, hooray for that. I also have huge admiration for those competitions because I can only imagine how many applications they get.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, cutting off the age at 35, you know, it makes sense in terms of how you actually manage to look at all those videos and all those applications.
Yeah.
As soon as there's no age limit, so the workload's going to double.
Yeah, of course.
For my own sake, I mean, one of the conductors we've got at the Royal College is in his late 30s.
Oh, and
fantastic. I was really keen to make sure that, because we all come to conducting at different times, at different ages.
Yeah.
And it's not like learning the piano or the violin. We, you know, probably a lot of, you know, like the archetypal Russian child who's, you know, straight out of the cradle and given a violin.
One, here you go.
you know, we can't conduct until we're already experienced musicians.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, you have to be a good musician, then you can conduct.
Yes.
I think teaching conducting to people who are younger is also hugely beneficial to them.
Yes.
Because of the awareness they'll develop about how to approach a score, all kinds of things, the way the orchestra works. And orchestra, of course, is a you know, a microcosm of society as a whole, and the way you listen and interact and respect one another. So there's so much good which comes out of orchestras and conducting for young people. But we all mature, like wine, you know, we all mature at different times. And it's so important not to hurry your personal development.
Totally.
And it's so easy to, you know, you see, oh my goodness, somebody 22 has just won this competition. Well, how am I going to cope? You know,
it's hard.
I got somebody yesterday was talking to me. He says, oh, I'm 26. I don't know what I said. Do you have any idea? you're hardly even starting.
Exactly.
So it's always that thing about trying not to compare yourself with other people who maybe have got that break earlier on.
Yeah.
And just keeping believing in yourself, believing in your potential, mm-hmm. because we all, so the other question people always ask is, so how do you, what's the career route for a conductor?
Oh God, yeah. Where to start?
It's different. There is no career route.
Yeah.
There are options mm-hmm. which you can guide people towards.
Yeah.
So you can say, so do you love opera? Mm-hmm. Number one question, you know, mm-hmm. and because if people are really excited by opera, then look, there are so many routes. If they can play piano, even better. They can, you know, the option of a German opera house going in as a repetiteur,
totally
building up, you know, is such a fantastic way of building yourself as a conductor and being fully immersed in the opera world and the opera culture. If you're not interested in opera, and if you maybe don't have an affinity with singers, or heaven forbid, because everything's about singing, but anyway, you know, every instrument is about singing.
Totally, couldn't agree more.
But the other option is, of course, you know, you look at, okay, competitions, but that's just one. It's just one possibility. If you win a competition, mm-hmm. you perhaps have the possibility to build a career.
Maybe, but
it just opens. It opens some doors. You'll get lots of concerts, but then the question is, will you be invited back?
Yes, totally.
Are you ready for that?
Yeah.
You know, are you going to have a manager who's going to look after you and nurture you?
Yes.
And not try and push you too hard, because otherwise you'll burn out. Mm-hmm. And then there are fellowships and assistantships.
Yeah.
More and more of the orchestras are creating official fellowships and assistantships, which are great. But the other thing which is really important is to build, for each individual conductor, is to build up a relationship with the conductors they admire.
Yeah.
Initially, probably by saying, you write to their managers and say, please, can I attend your rehearsals? Please, can I, you know, learn from observing?
Yeah.
And at some point, that person might come and have a conversation with you, or you might talk to somebody in the management of the orchestra, and suddenly they might say, we need a conductor at short notice. Are you free?
Yes, yeah.
For your, anything like that can happen, but building up your personal network of people you admire and respect, and who... So it's very important not to be over pushy. Mm-hmm. So if you write to somebody and say, I want to be your assistant, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
But if you write to somebody and, you know, gently build a relationship and, you know, attend their rehearsals, show mutual, you know, show your respect.
Yeah.
And hopefully at some point there may be a way that brings rewards and that brings benefits. But even if it doesn't get you a job, it's going to enable you to learn how to rehearse a professional orchestra.
Yes.
Because totally. That in itself is such, it's like a muscle.
Yeah.
And we at the beginning we were all conducting student orchestras and amateur orchestras. Mm-hmm. That's one muscle. Mm-hmm. And in an idealistic kind of way, you'd think, well, the priorities are exactly the same. And actually a lot of the time what you rehearse with a professional orchestra is very similar to what you need to say is often very similar to what you need to say to a student orchestra or a semi-professional orchestra. Same difficulties in terms of balance, yeah. note length. But with a professional orchestra, there's so much less you need to say.
Exactly.
But you need to say everything in exactly the right way. You can't waste any time. You can't, if you say the wrong thing, you've lost them. So it's like if you start trying to tread water, they don't know what they're doing, yeah. and you've lost them.
Yeah.
So there's always that thing, don't say anything if you've got nothing to say.
Exactly.
And just trust that, you know, the more, obviously as conductors, we want to be able to show everything. And sometimes you need to say something.
Yes.
So the less we say, the better.
I want to give Mark Wigglesworth's book a big shout out here, because it's one of the finest pieces of conducting literature that I've read, and just so honest. I know it came out during the pandemic and a lot of people did read it, but if you haven't, please read it, because everything Toby is saying and more is in there, and just about being honest and the honesty. And for me, it's funny you mention the German route and the opera scene. My piano skills were not great. Good to a certain extent, but not that good. And I struggled for a long time not having what I thought was a path. Now, of course, I know there was never a path, but doing all the different things that eventually obviously led me, and I'm really happy where I am now. But it took a very long time. I almost felt like I wasn't a musician for a lot of that. And I know it took me to 28 when I won my first or my probably my second big fellowship, but the fact that it was full time. The first one had been part time, even though it was huge. The second one was full time with a smaller institution. However, I felt, okay, now I can call myself a conductor, which is just so silly. The fact that we're governed by how many hours we're doing it and what we're doing and how we're getting there rather than just believing in it. So I would say, you know, echoing everything Toby is saying, but also doing what's right for you, because the German system was never right for me.
Yes, it's so important to know when something isn't right for you.
Yeah.
And I mean, so Mark Wigglesworth is, you know, he's one of the best opera conductors, but he's not a pianist and he hasn't done the German opera house system.
Yep.
But he created his own, I don't know whether he created his own opera company, but he was very instrumental in creating Opera Factory.
Right.
Which was about 30 years ago, I guess.
Wow.
And he just had a freelance career as doing opera.
Wow.
While having positions with symphony orchestras.
Yeah.
And he now conducts in Germany and across the world as well as an opera conductor.
Mm.
And also, when you are a bit more experienced, you can actually enter the German system without being a pianist.
Yeah.
Because in a bigger house, you can enter as a first Kapellmeister and you're not expected to play piano.
Yeah.
But for the smaller houses, you probably would need to play piano. And there's lots of information out there about the opera house system.
And Toby, I'm cutting across you. Go ahead.
No. But I was only going to say is, you see, I wish somebody had told me this when I was out of music college.
Wow.
Because my life would have been very different otherwise.
Well, and that's, you know, that really is the purpose of this podcast, because I have found, obviously I've had you and others around that have been amazing, but at the same time, there's very little out there for the middle person. There's everything. This is how you get to the top, you know, in a roundabout way. Do this, do this, do this. Some people drop off when they don't win things, or, you know, it just gets too much and they go a different path. But nobody talks about the assistant and what that is and how you get to that. And I personally believe that it's pivotal. You've mentioned some amazing names that I know have had huge impacts on you, and other people out there will resonate with that as well, and how important that is and where you go forward. And, you know, the title of this, And Other Duties, joking aside or jokes in, if you will, that's what it's about. It's about the and other duties. And I know when George was in his last couple of years at Sherborne, I very thankfully was there and got to witness it, and you were there, and a lot of people just chipped in to make his experience in those last years not just musically amazing, but physically and personally amazing for him as a person. And that's, all of those things are the and other duties. What were your and other duties? What things did you learn that, you know, it's that are not in a score and that we don't learn in music college?
Gosh, that's such a good question. I don't have a clear answer. I can only say you have to be an empathetic human being.
Mm.
And be aware of everything which is going on around you and how you can help.
Mm.
So somebody, I can't remember who this was who told me this, but I always thought it was great advice. He said he could sum up what makes a great assistant conductor as being able to spot a problem and resolve it before the principal conductor even noticed it had existed.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's that aware, and that was in an operatic situation. Actually, I think I remember who it was. It was James Henshaw,
who
was chorus master of E&O at the time. And I just thought it was the most fantastic description of you know, the way an assistant conductor can be kind of not in the way,
yep,
but diffusing any problems before they become an issue.
Totally. And that's down to, you know, that's down to moving a musician back or forth. That's down to a camera angle if you're streaming. That's down to photocopying another page because somebody needs a page turn. They're not always the small music things. They can be totally anything else.
Exactly. And actually, a lot of the time, it's often actually just giving moral support to the principal conductor.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a guest conductor in a big opera house, for some conductors, that's a very lonely experience,
yeah,
which sounds perverse. Because, well, there are so many people, but no, because you are an external individual.
Yes.
Coming into this huge company mm-hmm. of people who work together all the time. Mm-hmm. And they've seen all the other conductors, you know, and so you're standing there owning your interpretation, your way of doing things. And I'm sure that however much confidence that conductor shows or tries to show, mm-hmm. that, you know, there's a lot of insecurity. I think if we don't have insecurity, then we can't be good conductors, yeah. because we're not questioning ourselves enough.
Totally.
We always have to be, you know, there's always questioning, am I right? Am I right? But the thing is, obviously, when you stand in front of the orchestra, you've got to exude confidence.
Totally.
So it's the usual analogy of the swan, isn't it? You know, calm on the surface and the feet paddling like crazy underneath. So I think sometimes, Mark Wigglesworth is actually one of the best people to assist, because he treats the assistant as an equal. You're absolutely not an inferior or anything like that. He treats you as a musical equal, and he's really interested in all of your comments and what you've got to say.
Amazing.
And the most flattering thing which happens is, I remember after dress rehearsal, giving him a page of notes, you know, small things, and he fixed all of them by the way he conducted in the first performance.
Wow.
And that's what he does. And orchestral things too. He just fixes things by conducting differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I always give advice to people who are either assisting me or who I'm teaching at college about how to assist. And one of the things I advise is give me a list in three colors.
Yes. Yeah.
So you have red, things which have to be fixed.
Yes.
I mean, no, just have to be fixed. Another color, let's say green, things which would be lovely to fix if there's time.
Yes.
And let's say ordinary pencil for the third one, which are things which you can fix by conducting better in the concert.
I love it.
So, you know, and actually it's really, and it's just the pleasure you get as an assistant mm-hmm. when you feel that you have been part of the artistic process.
Yes, totally.
Of the final, of the end result, and not just somebody sitting there, you know, say, oh yeah, the balance there wasn't great,
yep.
or whatever, and then that might or might not get fixed. I mean, yeah. we've all probably assisted people who actually don't really like having an assistant.
Totally.
And
yeah,
and that's fine. That's
it's
fine.
It's also demoralizing though, because you feel like you're just sitting there for no reason. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's hard, but you're still learning stuff.
Yeah,
you're
that's
learning
true.
From
that's
seeing the true. Way they work. And sometimes you might only give one note. You might just say, look, for this acoustic, this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've contributed to something really useful and really helpful. Or it might just be the conductor might turn around and just need reassurance. Is that too loud? Is it too soft?
Yeah.
And you just give, you know, that, whatever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Job done. And it's that's what I mean about you have to be an empathetic and aware person, because it's going to be different in each circumstance and each situation.
Just a quick note to thank IT Passion for all of their support throughout this project and for sponsoring this series of And Other Duties, The Life of the Assistant Conductor. IT Passion support businesses across Ireland and Europe with all of their IT needs and solutions, allowing them to run their businesses efficiently and effectively. They are a huge supporter of local businesses and the music industry in Ireland. Thank you again to IT Passion for partnering with me on this season. You can find out more by visiting their website, itpassion.com, and on my social media. So what an amazing experience to have, as you said, be treated like an equal. It must have set you up for what was to come. But you also had this fellowship/assistantship in the middle of your already professional career. How did it change it, or what did you go on to or come from within that period?
A big part of me applying for the fellowship because I realized I needed to find a way to take my career up to the next level.
Yeah.
I had a relatively long period of being on a plateau.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, I need to do something different. I had created my own orchestra. That was all going fine, but I needed something different. And opera was clearly the way for me to do that. Mm. And the fellowship at E&O was an obvious thing to apply for. I also applied for the Yette Parker
Oh, yeah.
Young Artist at Covent Garden, And my keyboard skills weren't good enough.
Oh, wow. So you're great.
It was mainly because I was so nervous playing piano. And again, it was skills. And also it was other skills which I just had never been taught.
Mm.
I didn't know how to do recitative.
Yep.
You know, now I do, thankfully. But I just didn't at that point because it wasn't taught. So it's another thing is like at music college, I always make sure the students are taught, you know, opera as well as symphonic music.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm digressing. So the aim of the fellowship at English National Opera is to spend 2 years fully immersed in every aspect of how to run an opera company,
right,
as a musical director. And so I had access to every department, from marketing to wigs to, you name it. Everything was available. Anyone I wanted to talk to, I could talk to.
Amazing.
And obviously I was shadowing Mark and also any guest conductors.
Yeah.
And I got to conduct quite a lot of rehearsals and some performances as well. And at the end of it, I got to conduct my own production.
Brilliant.
Which was Turn of the Screw by Britten.
Yes, one of my favourites.
It's incredible,
isn't it? Really is so hard, but so that timpani part in the first act, wow.
incredible. And so I mean, since that point, actually, probably because of that position, I actually got my first work conducting in Ireland.
Oh, that's right.
In Dublin with Lyric Opera.
And you stayed with me for part of that, I remember.
Exactly. Yeah. I had many, many happy times conducting in Dublin. And I'm sure that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had that experience at English National Opera.
Yeah. Just goes to show how important, again, to bring back the age thing just for a minute, you know, you being that little bit older, more mature, assertive in yourself as a person and conductor, you were ready to leap straight from that. It didn't mean that you were looking for another fellowship. I'm not saying that you stopped learning, because again, we never do, but it gave you that confidence of, okay, yeah, I've done this. They've given me my own Turn of the Screw. Here I am in Dublin and, because I know you've done amazing things with opera since then.
But each time, there's still that, you know, there's still that little voice in your ear saying you're not good enough, you're not good enough. You know, there are people with more experience than you, half your age, you know, and it's kind of, you have to just keep fighting that gremlin.
Yeah, keeping it at bay and just going foraging forward with what you want to do and where, you know, where you want it to take you. Toby, in the midst of all of this, you're also teaching, because you had taught me before you got the ENO fellowship, and I loved what you said earlier about George turning around and saying, no, you need to go study with Musin, and how important it is to know when to leave a teacher, whether it's you knowing that or the teacher, which I think is amazing for a teacher to turn around and say, no, go. And you also alluded to not becoming looking like somebody, which is so dangerous, because we see, you know, we see them and we've been there ourselves where we mimic a teacher because that is sort of how you learn. What and how are you teaching differently now because of the assistant positions? A lot of people in the past that are amazing teachers had assistant positions, but assistant positions are changing and becoming more inclusive, as you've said. How do you manage the teaching of conducting and the teaching of assisting?
I think the teaching of assisting is part of... What you need to be taught obviously depends on what stage of your life or your training you're at. So the aim of the masters at the Royal College of Music, for example, is to prepare people for the profession.
Yes.
So by the time they leave, I want them to have had access to assisting, to doing opera, to doing contemporary music, working on composition for screen, collaborating with living composers is something I think is so important.
So important.
As well, of course, as an understanding of as much of the core repertoire as possible, and underrepresented composers as well,
yes,
which is so important to be aware of. And so assisting is something I integrate into the whole kind of program.
Amazing.
So right now we have Sakari Oramo conducting the symphony orchestra, and we have four master's students at the college, and they're all assisting him.
That's brilliant.
So he's doing Shostakovich 10. So we've kind of given them a movement each, which they'll take responsibility for as an assistant.
Yeah.
But it also depends on who the visiting conductor is. And most of them, because, I mean, look, let's be fair. If you're a very famous and great conductor like Zachary is, you don't need to come and conduct at the Royal College of Music. Yeah. You're doing it because you want to give back and because you care about education.
Yes.
So the kinds of conductors who are coming in to do projects at a music college, yeah, are going to very likely be the kinds of conductors who are really open and generous,
yes,
about connecting with the young conductors and giving them an experience.
Yeah.
Jack Van Steen is another one.
Yes, wonderful man.
Comes in regularly.
Yeah. Yeah.
He really understands about nurturing young conductors.
Totally. Yeah, he really, really does. I know I was very fortunate with Valentina Pileggi, who I know was also at ENO for a time. She was assisting Maren Alsop, and I was a Britain Peers Fellow, and I got to assist Valentina, assist Maren. And it was just so useful and very sweet. You know, Maren would say, Valentina, remember when you did this, and would embarrass her, you know, remember when you gave me too many notes or whatever it was. And so Valentina became that filter that we would go to her with the notes before she would give them to Maren. And sometimes she would give our notes, not hers. And it was just, I think it's so important. Teaching assisting isn't taught, you know, teaching how to, there's not much out there. I mean, you're doing it, but you have to be a student at the academy to do that. And it's something that I'm currently working on building and putting on courses for, because it's scary. You can't just learn how to conduct. As you said, you mentioned working with film, click track, all of those types of things are so important going out, because you're not going to walk out and conduct Shostakovich 10. You're going to walk out and do tiny little things for either recording or 10-minute operas or whatever it is, but it's never what you think it's going to be.
No, it's just about being ready for anything.
Totally, yeah.
And you also have to be able to talk to audiences,
yeah,
and talk to patrons,
yeah,
and make them feel special,
yes,
and welcome. And that's another thing which obviously was never taught in the past, but now it's expected, you know,
and
especially
you,
if you work in America.
Oh,
and you probably discovered
hugely,
that.
Hugely, yeah. I mean, I was at least 1 to 2 donor dinners a week, I think. And they become, I was talking to a conductor, music director about this recently, they end up not being donor dinners, they end up being your friends. But of course they are donors to the symphony, but you have to build up those relationships and meet the people, because they are what's funding the rest of it. But for me, I remember the first time I had to ask for money, I was told before I went on stage, you have to do the pledge tonight. I was fresh off the plane and I was like, nope, I'm not. And the development manager just looked at me and she was like, if you don't do this, your career is gone. You just have to learn. And I know the English are quite similar to the Irish. We don't ask for money. You know, it was huge. Luckily, it was an outside event and it was really dark, so I could just look into the pitch black dark and not at their faces. So it worked perfectly. And I did it and I was so proud of myself after doing it. And it became easier after that. But there's so many uncomfortable parts of this job that, I'm sorry, you just have to do it.
It's very hard asking for money for... You know, especially when there's so many horrible things going on in the world,
yeah,
which really do need,
yeah,
charity and support. And going out and asking for money for, let's face it, an entertainment which is predominantly white, middle class,
yeah,
what's the word? You know, when you've had advantages in life.
Yes,
you know,
totally. Yeah, privilege.
It's privilege, that's the word. And so it's, you know, it's a really tough ask. And so you have to think, well, how can I frame this in a way which focuses on the art?
Yes.
And the good that comes through music, and that we want everyone who supports the orchestra to be,
yep,
a part of that,
yep,
of that group of people, and you're part of that network.
I think the other thing to know, sorry Toby, jumping in.
No, I think you were going to say something much better than me.
I don't know about that. But you're going to be rejected, like you mentioned, being rejected from positions, and God knows I've had enough of it. You're also going to be told, no, I don't want to give you money. But one of the donors that I worked closely with said, I want to give it, and I don't just give to you. The money is there. I mean, some people are just in that privileged position where they have a lot of money and they give to a lot of things. They just want to help. And I know if you're empathetic, you think of all the reasons why not to ask, like, oh, I don't want to bother them with this, and oh, they gave this much this year and whatever. But you have to do it and let them be the decider of whether they want to give or not, and then not be offended by that. And it goes back to what you said about being honest on the podium. Being honest at those events, whether it's one-to-one dinner or coffee or just at a large event, just being honest. And this is where the money goes. This is how it helps. We need this. If you can help, it would be great.
Exactly. But it's also another reason why it's very hard for a conductor setting out on their career.
Yeah.
And maybe wanting to create an orchestra.
Yes.
To justify why anybody should give any money to that orchestra.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, why we don't need another orchestra of people who are just out of music college.
Yes.
We'd love another orchestra. But the fact is, we don't need one.
Yeah.
And so how do you justify it?
Yeah, but it's like anything, you know, we don't need another podcast. And yet here I am with brilliant sponsorship. But I think when you're passionate about something, that also comes across. And I've been really fortunate to have that in the sponsors for this podcast and many other things. If you believe in it enough, it will happen. It just takes time and it's a huge thing to have to do, but you just get out there and do it.
Exactly. And that belief in what you're doing is so important. I think if there's any doubt about what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I was just before the pandemic, I was about to launch an orchestra called Symphonia One. And it was going to be an orchestra of, believe it or not, one per part.
Oh, wow.
And I the reason I joke about it is because we've all become one per part
anyway.
Sick. Because you know, during the pandemic, that's all we could do.
Oh, don't remind me.
So that idea was also killed off by COVID. But actually now the idea is actually now developed.
Yeah.
Because I thought, no, I can't launch this orchestra. I don't believe in it anymore.
Yes.
And then we actually did a project together last summer, and I've now realized that the way forward for this orchestra is to be an orchestra of soloists.
Oh, nice.
So it's still called Symphonia One,
mm-hmm.
and it's not been properly launched because I don't have the money for it and funding and stuff. But
yes.
But it's still my dream that it's going to be a small chamber orchestra.
Yes.
It's not anymore going to be one per part because I just can't take any more of that. But but it's if it's an orchestra of soloists, then it means that when each concert you have something, a concerto or a solo work.
Yes.
That it's people from the orchestra who will be the soloists.
Yeah.
So you're not going to, you know, hire in some expensive soloist or somebody. Actually, the orchestra are so respected in their own right as soloists, mm-hmm. that they will be performing the concerto.
Wow, I love it.
And I was talking to a conductor about this just a couple of days ago, not about this orchestra, but a situation where he was conducting, I think it was BBC Symphony Orchestra or something, and the soloist was late. It was something like Wieniawski concerto, violin concerto, and violin six that I know the repertoire, stood up and just played it like they'd played it every day of their life.
Oh, wow. You know,
just fantastic. And that's the other thing you have to remember is there are so many great musicians in every orchestra you conduct. With and it. Just because they're sitting at the back of the second violins,
yeah, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't mean that they can't play fantastically.
Absolutely. Toby, a lot of questions I get asked are, you know, what are the differences between Europe and the US? And obviously, I've worked extensively as an assistant in both. And part of this podcast is trying to break that down, especially for US people trying to break into Europe and vice versa. I think we know this, but it's getting it out there. A lot of what you did all the way along, and you have alluded to it, but I want to highlight it, is creating your own things. And one is freelance in Europe from the minute you leave music college. There is no such thing as a full-time job until you got the fellowship at ENO, which still isn't a salary that you can completely live off. You still have to do all of the extra things. How was that for you?
I supplemented my income by teaching.
Yeah.
And doing as many guest jobs as I could.
Yeah.
And I was extremely lucky. And there's no question about that. I was extremely lucky because when I was a student, property prices were relatively low.
Yeah.
My parents helped me pay a deposit on a flat. And it had two bedrooms. So I rented out the second bedroom and I could basically pay the mortgage from that. So I basically was living for free.
Amazing.
And I know that's not possible now. So I realize that I was so, so lucky. Mm,
different times.
It's very different now when you need quite a significant amount of money just to survive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think teaching is an essential skill anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm always very happy when conductors I'm working with want to learn, to discover more about how to teach as well.
Yes, yeah.
And I always think teaching conducting is a very draining process, because in order to be a good teacher, you have to be so open and so connected, but also keep your own ego out of it.
Yes, yeah.
I just hate it when I see videos of conducting teachers just demonstrating and showing off. Nobody learns anything from that.
And, so true.
So creating your own opportunities is, on the one hand, if it's done well, you can earn some money from it. The trouble is that actually setting up your own orchestra is in itself an expensive process.
Yes, yeah.
So I think if somebody was moving to the UK, for example, from the States, or moving to Europe, they'd either need to have access to a good supporters network in order to create an orchestra, or that route, I think, would be too ambitious to begin with.
Yes, yeah.
It would be better to find a fellowship somewhere. Mm. There are fellowships at Royal Northern, at mm-hmm. Trinity, Royal Scottish Conservatoire. I'm sure I've missed out a number, but and some of the orchestras are creating fellowships. If a Halle has one.
Yes, yeah.
Liverpool Philharmonic just created one.
Yeah.
Bournemouth, exactly. So there are some really wonderful opportunities there. The difficulty is, if you haven't studied in that city,
yep,
then you won't have the network of people who you could call on to do you favors.
Totally.
So
yeah.
So if you're just at a music college, you'll probably find, I mean, again, all students now have student fees to pay and stuff. So it's not really good to ask people to play without paying them.
Yes, yeah.
However, I think they also realize that if a fellow student asks them to play, that they're all in the same boat, and therefore they don't feel that they need to be paid.
Yeah.
If they're playing for an official orchestra,
yeah,
I don't even mean a fully professional one, but like one of the stepping stone orchestras, then they also should expect to be paid.
Yes.
They should be paid properly.
Yeah.
But the, you know, an orchestra of friends playing together, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And that's something you would have access to if you've been connected, or if you are connected to a music institution.
Yes. I think it's about not being afraid to connect as well. And something that you've done, which has been amazing, and I mentioned it in the opening, was Conductors in Isolation, which was just such a haven for me, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, and continues to be. You know, there are questions up there every day. And I know it's a minefield trying to decide where you're going to go and what's best for you and what route. But the connections that we make truly are fascinating and take you on crazy journeys to meet and stay with people. You know, I'm going to Germany, I can't afford a hotel, can I have your couch? I'm, you know, coming to conduct in wherever for a month and I can't afford the Airbnb, do you know anybody that has a spare room? I think it's making all of those connections are so invaluable.
Yes, and that was one of the things in the pandemic which I'm very proud of.
And so you should be.
Of creating conductors in isolation. But, you know, I just had the idea. It was everyone else who made it happen. because they came, you know, and contributed and were part of the conversation, and part of the group dynamic. And for people who don't know about this, what basically on the first day of the pandemic, so I got my job as head of conducting at the Royal College just one month before the pandemic. Partly because of that position, I felt I was in the right place to be able to create an environment for early career conductors and professional conductors to come together and share their knowledge. So on the first day of the pandemic, on the first day of lockdown, I remember emailing every conductor I could think of saying, let's just meet on Zoom this evening and have a chat. And that became every single evening except for Sunday.
Yeah, that's right.
for the best part of 2 years, basically.
Yeah.
And it's got On average, we had between, I'd say, 50 and 100 people per night, per evening.
Totally, yeah. And it was beautiful. Yeah. You know, we could have a gin and tonic. We could talk. And I know it was quite difficult. At one point, I was very fortunate to get back to the States much earlier than people were creating music in Europe, for example. But that also became really nice and nice to share with people when the UK and Ireland and Europe in general was opening up. Well, how did you do this and how did you manage that? I don't know that we'd have survived the pandemic without it as conductors.
It was a real beacon, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally.
And for me, it gave structure to my day. Obviously, I spend at least half of the day often preparing the evening session.
Yes.
Especially if there was a guest speaker.
Yeah. You
know, and then the evenings, there's always that thing at 6 o'clock, we'd log on.
Yeah.
We would just be together.
Yeah.
And that was so special because otherwise, you know, conductors don't meet very often.
Nope.
Because... Yeah, we're on our own.
Yeah, and isolating. Well, conductors. Yeah. I didn't actually mean that.
Well, no, you've hit the nail on the head because that's partly why I thought I'm not going to change the name of the the name of the group
because actually, we are always
in isolation. Yeah. It's a lonely job.
It's lonely, and to have that board of directors, and again, that's what this podcast, like each and every guest that I have selected, has been for a reason. You know, it's been a pivotal part in my journey, or somebody that I've met because I want to highlight to every conductor, you know, whatever age, whatever stage they're at, that we need that board of directors, that we need those people around us. And I say board of directors loosely, but it's as much as picking up the phone and saying, hey, Toby, I'm making my debut with da da da. I have no idea what they're like. You know, can you help? Or I've never conducted this piece. What are your three things? We need that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's just hope that people will continue sharing in that way, and I think great conductors. I was going to say something which actually was I think is not true. I was about to say great conductors are also normally generous hearted, but that's just not true.
No, it's not.
But the conductors we love, let's say.
Yes, that's true.
I think are generous hearted and willing to share. I mean, I heard a story. From a really lovely conductor called Leo McFall, and he went to see Abbado conducting Beethoven 7, and he was actually assisted Abbado as well. But Leo was he went backstage, and Abbado went through the score with him.
Oh, wow.
Sat down at the piano and said, "I do this, or they don't like this when I do this, or whatever," and was going through the score with him, and you know that generosity apparently. Somebody I gave some help to has been assisting Petrenko with the Berlin Philharmonic.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just, and there's that immediate.
Totally. Yeah.
Connection and sharing of experience and knowledge. And that's the sort of person. So this is the big advice I wish I could give myself now, my younger self from 30 years ago or something, which is you're never too grand to be an assistant.
Yes, and thank you for saying. Geez, Toby, I didn't even script that. Can you say it again? It's like perfect.
Because, you know, I was just thinking, just something came to me and I was talking about, there's Abbado, you know, doing saying these things. So when I was George Hurst's student, Moosen's student, I was, okay, I mean, I was sort of their golden boy.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I was the model student.
Yeah.
Did everything I was told, did everything well. And, you know, there was, oh, Toby's got everything. And so I thought, you know, the phone was going to ring and I'd have a career.
Yeah.
And I left music college, silence.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. And because I was too grand, mm-hmm. I thought that it would just happen without me having to fight for it.
Mm.
And that's partly why I created my own orchestra. That's why I went for the Fellowship of International Opera, because I realized I needed to build a career. And I thought, oh my God, I've left it too late.
Yes, yeah.
And so I'm on a different path to the one I perhaps would have been on had I given myself that advice, you know, when I was 24.
Yeah.
But I'm very happy with the road I'm on. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm extremely fortunate. But I remember thinking, no, I shouldn't be assisting people. I should be doing my own project.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I be somebody's assistant? And how wrong I was.
Mm.
I mean, that was such a mistake because no conducting course, no program, no masterclass will train you what it is to be a professional conductor. That's something you can only really work out for yourself through doing it and being there and being immersed and surrounded in it. And so being an assistant is an essential part of your personal development and developing. I mentioned the muscle you need to keep developing or else you never build it. And that's it. You know, you develop that muscle by training with other people.
Yes. Yeah. Being around them and just experiencing it, feeling that energy. Toby, I could talk to you absolutely all day. I have a list of questions in my head that I would love to keep going on, but the clock is ticking. You've probably already answered it, but is there any, you know, other parting piece of advice or the and other duties, or maybe that last statement was it?
Well, the last statement's certainly a very important one. Yeah, I mean, you're never too grand to be an assistant. I would say the other really important bit of advice is be patient. Yeah. Don't be in a hurry. You can only develop at the speed which is right for you. Yeah. And that takes nerves of steel.
Yes.
When you see other people
rising,
going past you on the elevator.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean you're not going to catch up, and it doesn't mean you're not going to have a really valuable career of your own at the right moment.
Yeah.
And that's where it's scary. You know, it's just don't compare yourself to other people. Just be true to yourself and don't hurry. Just take your time.
I love it. Toby, I want to share one anecdotal story which is sort of linked to teaching, because you've mentioned the most amazing teachers, and obviously you were a huge part of my life, and it's so important to have the right teachers. And at Sherburn, I studied with you for many, many years, and also Denise Ham, who was amazing with my technique and just fixed so much. But I remember there was one thing she couldn't get me to do, and her heart was broken. I think she was about to ditch me as a student, like, this girl, I brought her as far as she can go. And it was at Sherburn during the summer, and Denise was, you know, again, banging her head against a wall with me. And you got up and you were like, just try this. And I did it. And Denise looked at you and it was like, I've been trying to get her to do that for a year. And it was just, it was a pivotal moment. It was actually about having weight in my hand, because I was terribly flicky, and whatever you did just changed it. But the beauty of Denise trusting you and me trusting both of you, and it being a team, just brings it all back to, you know, being surrounded by good people, good teachers, good mentors, good schools, and not being afraid to reach out.
Exactly.
Toby, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think if there's ever a series two, we need to do part two of this, because we could talk all day. But thank you for being so honest and candid, and for breaking barriers for so many people, and for teaching the next generations of conductors and assisters and leaders out there. You are just such an invaluable resource.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's been such a pleasure. I'm really grateful to be part of this amazing series you've put together. So big bravo to you for making it happen.
Thank you. And more soon. Take care. As part of this podcast series, And Other Duties wants to highlight rising businesses within the Irish music industry. Music Literacy Ireland, brainchild of Dr. Michaela Boland, is just that. Music Literacy Ireland has a key focus on supporting music educators within the private sector, working with second and third level institutions and generally trying to increase awareness of music education across Ireland. This is something, as assistant conductors, we are always doing. You can check out their website, musicliteracy.ie, as well as my social media for upcoming dates and workshops. What another fantastic week with Toby Purser on And Other Duties. It truly is amazing hearing these stories every week. They are so diverse. And we talk about this community that you should create, that we need all around us all the time. Toby, of course, has done just that with Conductors in Isolation. Don't forget to find them on Facebook and join. Ask all the questions. Every day things come up, from what score should I buy, what score bag should I buy, what camera will I use, or just how are you getting on? And it's a really lovely resource. Join us next week for yet another journey and another different journey. A huge thank you to IT Passions for supporting this series of And Other Duties. Take care and see you next week.